Welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, hosted by Dr. Ryan Mauley and Travis Buzzell. Join us on this journey as we educate the patient population, inform today's medical providers, and inspire tomorrow's medical leaders through education and in-depth discussion. We can all discover today's best healthcare solutions. Now, sit back and enjoy Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Sawbones-Molly, and
Travis,
my co-host,
Travis Buzzell.
And today we got a great guest out of Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about him, Trev.
Yeah, so we're able to kind of catch up a little bit here and get to learn a little bit more about him. And I'm so happy that we're able to finally reschedule this. And we've been kind of going back and forth. But so he is a healthcare and med device entrepreneur, as you said, based out of Atlanta, Georgia. Preston Alexander.
Hello. Welcome,
Preston. Good morning.
Thanks for having
me. How are you? Thanks for joining us on a Saturday morning. Kind of different doing this in the morning than in the evenings with coffee. I kind of like it.
Sure you snuck some Baileys in your coffee.
I was gonna say, the opaque is a good one. I have my I don't know if you guys know Seth Chernoff, but I have my
The stash.
Yes, I love that.
I know, so that's how I'm rocking it this morning.
Well, good
no
morning
comment, what's in here?
Yeah, I did mine in the driveway. I didn't drive over with that.
Let's do a wrap.
So yeah, normally we just start this off, Preston, if you could just give us a 2-minute, as Dr. Mauley likes to say, 30,000 foot view of kind of you, your background, what brought you to healthcare, and you know, where you started and where you are now.
Yeah, love to. Thank you. So I started by accident in healthcare with a job as a product manager at a global med device company. Bounced around only slightly, went from one global company to another, and just sort of fell in love with healthcare. Thought it was wildly fascinating and interesting, especially from a business perspective to start with. But then over time, sort of had these suspicions, and I was like, there's more to this than, you know, selling some disposable goods to the OR nurse manager, right? More's going on here besides what I see in this sort of very small sliver. So I started writing about healthcare really as a means of self-discovery and self-learning. And over the years and, you know, hundreds of connections and conversations, started really diving deep and understanding just so much more of what's happening in the U.S. healthcare system. And write about it now pretty regularly on LinkedIn and via a newsletter called The Healthcare Breakdown, where we break down the business of healthcare to expose the healthcare breakdown. Because I'm all about repetition and puns. And, along that pathway and journey, I started a medical device company, sold it. And now in my spare time, I try to help physicians launch new private practices and help doctors who are in private practice escape, the administrative burden, run financially successful practices, and stay totally independent. Because this core belief that independent physicians and clinicians in leadership, private practice, entrepreneurship, non-clinical health system leadership is really critical in correcting some of the issues in the healthcare system. So that's me. I live in Atlanta with two kids who are way cooler than I am and occasionally go rock climbing.
So Preston, you mentioned you have two daughters, right?
Yes.
Was that the influence, or who gave you the Taylor Swift of LinkedIn title?
Oh, yeah. Well, we do listen to quite a lot of Taylor Swift in this household. Big fans. But actually, I was just driving with my wife one day, and she goes, you're like the Taylor Swift of LinkedIn. And I was like, that seems pretty grandiose to be the Taylor Swift of all LinkedIn. But I also thought it was funny. So like, maybe I'll narrow it down to be the Taylor Swift of LinkedIn healthcare writing. So I tried to get as niche as possible, but that's how it came up. We were just driving and she made a joke about it. And I was like, this is funny. I'm going to put that on my LinkedIn.
Yeah, no, I like it. That was one of the first things that caught my eye when I kind of saw your profile. And then I started following you and just your insight. I was like, who is this dude? Like, Even before we started talking earlier off air, Travis and I were like, what is he? He's not a doctor. And I'm reading it. And then you talk to us. I'm like, all right, I'm starting to understand this a little bit better now.
Yeah.
The picture, the puzzle is starting to get pieced together here a little bit more.
Yeah. We got about two or three pieces together.
I get it a lot.
People who like, and they're like, so like, what do you do? Who are you? What's going on here? Like, you write this stuff and I don't get it. Where did this come from? And it just evolved over time by a lot of sneaking suspicions and just internal feelings of, you know, things not adding up, and then just a long path of self-discovery and learning.
Well, I think that's awesome. And I think, you know, just kind of listening to your story a little bit, I mean, obviously I think a lot of what you do and your beliefs and just sort of the mindset definitely aligns with, you know, us, just, you know, sitting over, you know, here in Pennsylvania. But I think just the one thing that I think is very interesting is just the kind of that mechanism of like LinkedIn and that social media aspect. You know, I do feel like there's obviously so much negativity that comes along with social media in general, but, you know, this sort of platform to be able to create this community and, you know, kind of put your opinions out there and find out that you might not be the only one who has that opinion, or, you know, is sort of like, I'm going to say like rise against the machine, but, you know, sort of like, hey, maybe there's another way to do this. I just find it so interesting. All the guests that we talk to, and LinkedIn sort of seems to be, you know, a commonality with community of people that are, you know, have that entrepreneurial independent mindset. Like, you don't have to do this the traditional way. And there are a lot of other people out there like me that feel that way.
If you think about it, Trav, like all of our episodes, yeah, what's the common denominator? LinkedIn.
100%.
I mean, and not only just like the podcast guests we've had Adrian Towson, we've had,
yeah,
who we're going to get to meet in person, Preston, together this week. All those people that we're meeting in mid-central Pennsylvania, Chris McClellan, Wendy Hood. I think there was another surgeon that's going to be joining us, Chris, or can't remember his name off the top of my head right now, but that was all LinkedIn conversations that were going on there. You know, Johnny Cafaro, yeah, Marty Nichols, all those individuals. It's, yeah, like that's the common denominator. And I've had the opportunity to actually meet some of these people in person now for a couple times. Peter Varillo was, yeah, from Redefined Surgery. Richard Southgate, Spencer Montgomery, Brian Fuller. You know, I was at AUKUS, got to meet those guys in person. So it's like, it's almost like a fraternity. And it's great that we can start to share, you know, clinical stuff like, hey, this is a tough case I had. What do you think? What would you do? But to me, I did not. I know you mentioned earlier when we were speaking offline that you got your MBA. Looking back on things, and I told you I started my own private practice, I've never had one business class in my entire life. I kind of wish that, and I think that medical school should focus a lot more on that. I understand that we need to learn all of the sciences and things like that, but man, I wish I would have had some secondary type of degree,
yeah,
such as a business degree, or at least some classes in it. We never once talked about private practice. We never talked about how to start a practice. We never talked about managing overhead. So for a young surgeon, you know, to do this, I was, 39 when I started my own? Like, I don't know many people that just start practices, yeah, like that.
Well, and I'm not making like accusations per se, but, you know, Dr. Blake, you know, your buddy in Michigan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember something that he said that has stuck with me the whole time. It's like, you know, I never had a business class. I didn't really know anything about private practice, but it's almost like, I almost feel like
it's intentional.
He insinuated that it was intentional.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want you to be a business person. I just want you to be a doctor. And it's just like, okay, well, what does that mean? And now it's just like these, you know, massive organizations just like, just use and abuse you. It's just like, I'm the person using the scalpel, not the scalpel.
I do believe, and I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theorist, but I do believe there's some intentional behavior there.
Yes, intentional behind it.
Just definitely. Because I've sat in those hospital CEOs' offices where they say, hey, we don't want you to worry about any of the burden of running the practice or how to run a practice. And they honestly don't even want us. We ask for numbers like, well, how much does this case setup cost? Oh, yeah. And then we'll get you that info. 5 years later, you still don't have that information. So it's like, what's going on here? Like, why is there no transparency? And they try to make it seem like they're out for our best interests. Like, you just practice medicine, go home, be with your family, do all the dictations that you need to do in your med rec system. So, I mean, I think we should just dive in, Preston, because we can sit here and bitch and moan all day about this, but there's obviously an issue. There's obviously a problem. That's the sole reason why we started this podcast, Private Practice Podcasters. I mean, it's in the name. I'm very, very passionate about private practice. I want the second half of my career to be known for not only practicing excellent medicine, but helping to be one of the people that helps to spark the pendulum to swing back towards private practice, because it's gotten so far the opposite direction. And we all know that the pendulum continues to swing. I don't think it'll ever get back to the point where it was, where everybody was private practice, and probably doesn't, probably shouldn't be that way, because there are certain people that are probably better off hospital employed. But what do you see from your standpoint as a non-physician, but, and what was it that made you so passionate about trying to help independent physicians and private practice physicians?
Yeah. And just to go back for a second, because I love a good conspiracy theory.
All right. Let's do it.
Tinfoil hats.
It's over there. I didn't put it on today, but
shelter. It's good.
That's fine.
This is the tree.
They can't hear us.
But yeah, I definitely think that it's intentional. You know, and even if you look at the higher education system broadly, I hope my stepdad's not listening to this. Yeah, he was a dean of a business school for 17 years and the president of a university for 8 years. Big education background family. But education systems, even broadly, does not foster leadership, and it doesn't foster entrepreneurship. And when I was in business school, I would say that the worst class I took was a class on entrepreneurship. I mean, it made no sense and I learned nothing in it at all. It was a huge waste of time. So it's not just a medical school phenomenon. I'd say it's a higher education phenomenon. But then especially when you get into the medical school realm and you look at the interests of a hospital, you know, they would like as much of a flow of physicians and other clinicians as possible, not asking questions, and signing non-competes that are ridiculous and incredibly restrictive, and effectively having, you know, complete control over those mechanisms. And then there's also obviously a connection with the residency slots and the funding that they get for that. And, you know, they want to be just in the driver's seat the whole time. And then if you look at the numbers, though, to your point, Dr. Molly, I mean, an orthopedic surgeon, for example, I mean, I don't know, you can generate for a hospital, a single doctor, even pretty soon out of school, $3 million in you know, billing, and they're going to pay you, you know, $400K or whatever it is, which is a lot of money. And especially after you have all the medical bills, you haven't made money for, you know, 10 years or something. You're like, hell yeah, I'm going to make $400K. That's great. And then they're, you know, pocketing millions on a person. So if they showed you that, you'd be like, hold on a second. This math ain't mathin. Why am I here doing this? You know, this doesn't really make sense. And if you ran the numbers in a, on a private practice on the flip side, you'd be like, wow, they're paying me $400K. I mean, that's a lot of money. That's really great. But like, if I, you know, it may take some time, take some grind, take some legwork, but like, I could go and be getting, you know, I don't know, 800K in distributions or 900K or whatever, or this limitless upside, depending on how you build something that's your own. And if you really start to look at that, you realize the imbalance in the mechanisms. Because if every doctor knew, there'd still be a high percentage of people employed for sure, but there'd be much less. And to your point about the pendulum, despite us seeing it continue to go up and employment's going up, you know, we're at 77-78% now across health systems and insurance companies and large corporations. I think the sentiment is going in the exact opposite direction.
Yeah.
Most doctors are like, yeah, I'm here, but I hate it. But this is the worst, but I don't know what to do. I can't, I have non-competes. I have golden handcuffs. I have all these things. So this sort of like, it's pull, like the trend is starting to pull down. And to your point, I don't think we're going to go back to the 70s or 80s, but if we can certainly get below 70% employment and then just have better pathways for those who want to be in private practice. And to answer your original question before I went back to, you know, conspiracy theory, which I don't think is really much of a conspiracy theory. I think it's pretty true. The reason I got passionate about this is I just, as I was writing and talking to people and seeing more, it became just sort of a question of who is making the decisions, who's pulling the strings, who's in the power seat, I guess. And it wasn't patients, it wasn't physicians, it wasn't nurses, it's not PAs, it's not NP, it's no clinician, it's not pharmacists, it's like, you know, it's these people we don't know about who sit in like corporate offices far away from where like healthcare is actually being delivered. And just this wild disparity, like, you know, everyone says like Medicaid, for example, is like a terrible payer and you can't make money in private practice off Medicaid, which I have differing opinions about. But then Centene Corporation, which is a Fortune 500 company that makes billions of dollars, almost exclusively is in the Medicaid business. So how can they be in the Medicaid business making billions while private practice is suffering and the people who need the care the most aren't getting the care that they need because Medicaid is such a bad payer and not paying people enough, you know, doctors enough money. So it's just this sort of overwhelming feeling of just such a disconnect between the business and like the practical medicine side. And then as a patient, I mean, I go to a hospital or a health, like I'm just, you know, I'm sat there in the ER and everyone's kind of pissed off that I'm there or whatever else, or, you know, I'm getting rushed out and it's 4 minutes and it's like behind the computer, but I get it and I'm very empathetic to it. But if I go to a private independent doctor, you know, I can tell a difference. They spend the time with me, they talk to me, because, you know, despite you, as you mentioned, not having like a formal business background or that education, I think so much of business is far more simple and practical than they would have you believe.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, costs you X amount of dollars to open the doors every day. And as long as you see the right amount of patients and you know how much money you're bringing in and you treat them nicely.
That's it. That's it right there. And
you know,
going back to the one book,
Unreasonable
Hospitality, was such a impactful, powerful book that I read, you know, a year and a half ago. And I had my whole leadership team read it. It's like, you said it right there. And it's just like simple stuff that your parents teach you. You treat people how you want to be treated. And I always treat every patient, and I tell my patients this, I'm going to treat you as if you were my mom or my dad. And if you genuinely do that, the rest will take care of itself, right? You don't have to worry about, you have to keep an eye on the dollars and cents. And that's why I have a business manager and I'm looking at those reports and I'm very in the know with the financial health of the practice. But you can't make that your goal, right? It's, if you deliver, for me, it's an experience for my patients. I want them, when they walk in, to be like, holy crap, look at this building, look at this team. And we get it every day where it's like, your team is amazing here and at the hospital because we're passionate about it. We're committed. It's a culture that we've created. Yeah. It's tough. And to maintain that culture is work every single day. It's not like there's unicorns and rainbows everywhere, right?
I think the other thing too, though, I mean, there's like a lot of things to unpack, at least for me, that, you know, in that little snippet of conversation. But I'd say the one thing about Dr. Molly, of kind of going through that, is like, be about what you're talking about, though. Like, I've had several situations where I've been like, where's Dr. Molly at? Like, I thought he'd be done operating by now. And he's like, yeah, no, he is. But this patient was here in the hospital for hours and they can't get a hold of their ride. Right? Their loved one didn't come pick them up or whatever. And the surgeon who has operated now on six patients, done six total joints, did all the things that he's responsible for, and then drives a patient an hour to take the patient home. Like, those are the sort of things that for me, like, when it's like you're hearing these conversations, and you know, a lot of people say that. They're like, oh yeah, okay, unreasonable hospital, okay. But when you practice what you preach, I feel like that there is where the disconnect that we're talking about, like, that's where things start to change a little bit.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And the disconnect stuff is like, you know, like that sort of story, right? And like the, you know, you'll never catch like anyone in the practice or like step, like you never see someone that's like in a wheelchair or like with a walker that you just see is struggling. You never see that person go out to their car on their own. There's always a staff member standing at that door to open that door all the way through the parking lot, whether it's snowing outside, which lately this winter, at least more frequently, and then the
get ready, Preston.
It's ready. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, the wild part to me about that disconnect, Preston, that you were talking about is like, okay, that experience, that sense of detail, that sense of personal sort of, you know, relationship, very, very good outcomes, very, very minimal, you know, downside in terms of infection rates, you know, those other, you know, things that can happen, complications, that sort of stuff. Yet someone in another part of the country who doesn't have great outcomes, maybe has a, you know, significantly higher uptick of infection, you know, satisfactory, not so great. Insurances, those people get reimbursed the same amount of money. SPREP, same procedure, same code. All the other things that go into that have nothing to do with, you know, that the experience or the economic side of it. And it's just like, from my perspective, it's like if you build a house and you have one builder that is, you know, great finish work and, you know, the materials that are used, et cetera, it's just like, okay, well, that guy gets paid more. It costs more for that house because it's better than this builder who's less expensive, cheap. I like to say less expensive. It doesn't cost as much money. It's like, why in healthcare, from just like a standard baseline, everyone is like, it's the same procedure. We have both the implants better.
We're like the only profession where like we don't control what we get paid. Right? Like at Starbucks, they can raise the price and it's not like, all right, I know you say it's $8 for my latte, but I'm only going to give you four. Well, okay, well then you can get half of the latte or you don't get it at all. Right. But like every year you continue, instead of raising it because of inflation, you decrease it. So before we get off on a tangent and this podcast is called Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions for a reason, because I want to focus on the solutions. Yep. But before we do that, I do want to go back and just kind of paint a little bit about like, how do we get here? Because as we're sitting here, I'm listening to you. I think something else, like there's some intentionality Definitely. With how we've been trained, not only just physicians, but higher education, as Preston pointed out. But I think as physicians, there's also this perception in the world that like, and I do believe what I do, and my practice is a calling for me. It's almost like a priesthood. Like, but that doesn't mean that I'm doing things pro bono and I shouldn't worry or shouldn't have to think about getting paid for it, right? I'm still doing something and giving so much, and have given so much with 28 years of schooling of my life, delayed gratification, the burden of, you know, the worries of call, and my God, what, like you do 800 cases a year, you've got 800 potential disasters, right? Thank God 99% of them go great. But I think that this, I'm struggling for the word for this, but it's almost as though we're martyrs or like we're supposed to just kind of bear that cross and not worry about, we're greedy if we think about how much we should get paid for it, right? We should just be doing this out of the goodness of our heart because we took an oath, the Hippocratic oath, to do no harm. It's almost like, oh, you should just take what the insurance pays you and just be happy with that because you took this oath. And it's like, I don't agree with that at all. I mean, yes, I'm here to take care of my patients and I'm going to put everything I have into this. And a lot of times my family's going to sacrifice that. I'm not going to be here because I'm doing a patient educational seminar. Maybe I'm going to be a little late because I did take a patient home, but don't come down on me if I'm looking to try to run my business and still make ends meet, right?
I think though, the one thing that Preston said earlier Preston, I'd love to get your kind of thoughts on this is like the transparency though. I'm 100% in agreement with you in terms of that, but it's like, it would be different.
But even administrators try to play that card. They're like, oh, you're a doctor. You should be doing that. And it's like, dude, when's the last time you took a pay cut?
Yeah.
You want me to do more every year, but you want me to take a pay cut, whether it's the administration or the insurance companies. It's like, and the physician burnout rates through this roof, physician suicides through the roof.
And I think that's a part of the transparency of kind of what Preston had said, because, you know, for me, it's like a kind of like, my anecdotal, you know, right after that meeting with the administrator, and you're like, is that a helicopter right here? Yeah, that's how he's getting home today. It's like when that sort of stuff happens, it's like if there's transparency, it's like, okay, this is how much you're giving me. And that's, you know, 30% of the bundle, and then 10% is allocated, you know, and it's like you're the one who's doing, you know, the vast majority of, you know, the work for that reimbursement. And so it should be delegated as such, right? But there's other costs that go into that. And so, but there's no transparency in that, right? So it's just like that take what you get mentality and you should just do that. It's like, yeah, but if you knew that the other guys who aren't doing anything are sitting on a big bucket of billions of dollars, it's like, there's no equity in that. Like, I'm not suggesting like, hey, I deserve more. It's just like, I just want to be compensated fairly and appropriately.
And valued.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know, for me, that's like a part of the transparency. Preston, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I have a lot of thoughts on both of those things. I think one of the big, well, first of all, this sort of idea that, you know, a doctor has to be a martyr, and it's like, it's, you know, the altruism comes first and everything else. And it's, we've sort of divorced the two, the profession and the mission, is another control mechanism, because it's easier to, you know, pat somebody on the head and say, here's your $400,000 check. Please, like, just let us worry about everything else. And like, why would you complain? This is a lot of money, this, that, without seeing like, but never talking about the value of that. Like, if my knee doesn't work and I can't walk and I can't enjoy my kids and I can't go to the grocery store and I'm constantly in pain, and by the way, I can't really work as well as I normally do, and I'm constantly out, like, one, my life is worse. Two, I'm actually contributing less economic value to society in general. And we've like taken that out of the equation of like the service of doing like, you know, a TKA or some other procedure that's going to like effectively fix this big problem that I have. Or, you know, somebody somewhere far away said, well, this to the doctor is, you know, here's your $1,500 for like bringing somebody back to start contributing again to society and meaningfully and all these things. So we've taken like the value element and just sort of thrown it out the window and then made it just about like high compensation and things like that, which I think is pretty ridiculous. And then again, that sort of guilt tripping is just a bit of a control mechanism in all of it. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, highly problematic kind of what's going on. And there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, in being compensated and building a business that's delivering a ton of value. I think the other problem there is more from a perception standpoint of like any human being. So like, and this is just sort of everyone deals with this issue. It's like when I'm sick, so this is my normal level of like healthy. And then I'm sick and I'm dropping down to this level. No one's ever excited about paying to like fix something that should be working. Like if you're, you know, the AC goes out in your house, you're like pissed. You don't feel good spending $5,000 to like fix it. You don't feel good like fixing the, you know, your flat tire on your car. Other purchases that take you from baseline to up here make you feel good, right? Like you seek those things out. You're willing to pay the money because like you see a value trade-off in that. And I do think that in general, and I could be totally wrong, this is just like kind of an opinion that I've formed over some time, is that like even patients and people like can have a hard time recognizing the value of going from below their baseline back to sort of like a perceived normal. And then people leverage that to make, you know, to take you out of like the value equation, even though there's a ton of value there in getting people back. And then, I mean, there's plenty of people who are like, oh, I have my life back, and I like, and they do. But if you kind of look at it like really holistically, like overall, like, you know, in different areas of medicine too, like people with heart disease or this, or like fixing those people or helping them like lower their cholesterol or avoid a cardiac event and things like people don't totally inherently, I don't think, see the value in it, because they see the value in above baseline, not returning to it.
I've never ever thought about it that way. And that is a great analogy. But if myself or somebody else doesn't fix your knee, you're never going to get back here. And if you don't get back here, you're never going to be able to go to here. Right. Yeah. So even if you don't care to go to here, there's people that have just simple lives and they're very content with that. My parents are those people. But to get here, I think some people, as you mentioned before, they almost feel like it's their right, their innate right.
Yeah, and yeah. I was going to say maybe not a great descriptor in that, but like that entitlement, right? Like they feel entitled to it you know, because I call it the, you know, the insurance card entitlement, you know, and that goes back to that story of like, hey, I have this card. It's got numbers and letters on it. And doctor, fix me here. No, I'm not paying it.
Okay. It's already paid for.
I know that I agreed to this deductible, but I'm not going to pay it. So fix me. It's just like, you know, I never thought of it like that. But
it's also, I think, why we see like so many people like wait so long to get care. Because like, I think that there's obviously an access and a cost issue, 100%. But there's also like maybe my knee will get better. I'll just live with it. I'll just deal with it. It's fine. I'm fine. I can handle it. Until it's been 5 years and they can't anymore because the pain disparity is so big that they finally like can't handle it. And then, yeah, sure. Again, some people will be like, they see the value because it's so bad that they're like, wow, I can't believe I've ever felt this bad. And now I feel so good. And then they want their other knee done, right? Because they're always like, oh shit, I didn't realize my other knee was so
bad. Yeah.
But like it takes such a gap in pain. And so I feel like that's a big value disparity that like patients maybe don't always appreciate. And then on the flip side, I think the puppet string overlord finance people, they see it and they take advantage of that because they're like, yeah, you're just, you know, getting someone back to healthy. Let's keep you separate from it. Let's, you know, we're going to take care of the money. It's over here. Da, da, da. But to circle back just real quick to like one thing you talked about, especially the concept of like the red carpet too, and, you know, unreasonable hospitality, and how this dovetails into that discussion. You know, there's a story about a doorman, like at a hotel. And the MBAs come in and they see the doorman and they're like, we can just get an automatic door. We don't need a doorman. This guy costs a bunch of money. Let's go save, you know, 50 grand a year and we're going to fire the doorman. But so they fire the doorman, they save $50,000 a year. But as a result of that, a lot of the people coming in, they start to have this perception that it's a little of a lower value hotel. They don't get their bags handled as well. They're not as happy with the experience. People who don't, in a busy city. So, you know, sometimes people start kind of loitering around the front. People aren't getting their news, like doormen talk to each other in the hotel industry. So they know kind of like more of what's going on and he's really loyal to the hotel. So there's all this like other value that this person is bringing. But when you bring in this like just narrow myopic business perspective, when you like manage to a spreadsheet and to just the numbers, which is a lot of what happens in healthcare, and a lot of like the upside of private practice and a lot of the upside of sort of a lot of times having no formal business background, is because you just think in these like practicalities of how valuable this guy is versus like how much he's costing on an annual basis, and you fail to see the upside, especially when you manage from a distant site. And so that too, I think, lends itself to these disparities that we see, is because of this disconnect and out of touchness with, especially as a patient, we talk about value disparity and discrepancy. Like when I go in and I've had such an amazing experience, I'm happier to pay, right? Like I feel good about a purchase, even if it's a healthcare purchase. I'm like, that was amazing. Like I felt great about it. And it either creates more value on the upside, or at least reduces some of the pain of paying something, because you're like, wow, that was amazing. So it all really sort of, I know I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but it all really works together and is a complex tapestry. And again, one of the reasons why I think private practice makes so much sense. And, you know, does it fix all the problems? No. Do we still have interoperability problems and coordination problems and all that? Yes. But like it really just so fundamentally restores a patient physician relationship that is the basic requirement of the best and highest quality healthcare. And it's what we need more of.
Amen. When he's telling that doorman story, you know who that, what that reminds me of just in the whole health world is Jennifer.
Yeah.
So my wife and I, we started a cafe in our office to kind of pay tribute to our three boys. Our three boys are Anthony, Santino, and Luca. I took three letters from each of their names and I formed, I'm Italian, my wife's Greek, started a cafe with like a Mediterranean Italian themed menu and things like that called Luca and Tino's. And it's right in our lobby. And I'll be completely transparent. It makes no money. I definitely lose money on it every year. It was never the intention though. It was to create this experience so that patients, when they're there, and we've all been to doctor's offices where it's like, oh, I hate waiting in the lobby. I hate this. So I tried to make my lobby beautiful so it wasn't such a burden and interactive with, I have 32 TVs in my office, all streaming educational information about hip and knee and shoulder arthritis and different orthopedic conditions. But the cafe, Jennifer's more than a barista. Jennifer comes out and she talks to every single patient that's in there every day and just kind of sits down by them. Can I get you anything? And just chats with them. And like, I never told her to do that, but like, she's kind of taken that ball of unreasonable hospitality and awesome. Has run with it. And the cafe loves her. And her daughter, Mackenzie, is kind of my right-hand medical assistant. So it's kind of funny. I'll be in a room and they're like, oh, I just met your mother out there. She's so sweet. And she did this and did that and gave me a sample of the lemon bars. But, you know, I guess I really want to get into like the solutions, because to me, one of the main solutions is just like that unreasonable hospitality. But how can we take this pendulum that has swung so far with all these physicians that have golden handcuffs, non-competes? How can we give them the resources that, because to me, it's a lot of courage too, because a lot of these docs are very scared. They're very risk adverse. I have a very different personality where I'm just kind of like, I'm going to do this. And if failure is not an option, I understand it's not going to be smooth. It's going to be hard, but I'll figure it out. And in 2018, with no business experience, I was just so committed to like fulfilling my dream that I did it. And a lot of physicians were like, that's dumb, dude. You haven't thought this through. Like, where's your office going to be? Because I didn't have an office at the time. But I'm just kind of like, there's a little bit of faith there too for myself. And like, if I surround myself with really, really good people, like a core group of three to five really, really good people, we're going to make it through this.
Yeah. And, you know, I would like to, I guess, just kind of kick off, you know, the solution part of this conversation is like, it's exactly what we're doing, right? I think that fundamentally, and I think, you know, LinkedIn and, you know, our experience with LinkedIn has played an important role in that and just connecting people. But I think it starts with like building a community, right? Because one person trying to make a difference, I mean, we've kind of heard that, right? It's like, it's, you know, the one thing that my parents always taught me when I was a kid was be kind. You know, be kind. And if you be kind to one person, maybe that other person is kind to another person. And it should become kinds of
a ripple effect.
It's a ripple effect. And so I think the first thing is like creating a community. And that has already started. And I think you're finding that there are a lot of physicians who are not happy. I think you're finding a lot of physicians who are frustrated with, you know, the current model. And a significant amount of them that at least we have, you know, come, our paths have crossed, are already and have already started to unwind that model and kind of create their own destiny and, you know, get into private practice and, you know, look at, you know, what that can provide to them, not only just from like a work-life balance, but just like from like peace of mind and happiness and all those sorts of things. And, you know, I think that the more that we do that and the bigger this community gets, the more effective the movement will become. Because, you know, when you have, you know, 10, you know, surgeons that are going to an insurance company in a state to say, hey, you know, we really want to sit down and reevaluate, you know, these contracts and how we do this. And they're like, yeah, okay, buzz off, man. We'll talk to you later. We have a health system with, you know, 78 of you. So I'm not really interested in that. It, creating more of, like I said, that, you know, that bubble or that community to kind of, you know, power in numbers, sort of.
Yeah.
And just continue to sort of talk about some of these things. But I think the other piece of this is, and I, you know, I know that you'll talk about this, but you know, your motto for 2025, it's like action, right? We can like talk about this stuff. And I think we have created some solutions with just, you know, this platform and having the conversation, but we just need to start doing stuff, getting together, getting the groups together. And like you said, just trading, kind of, I don't want to say trade secrets, but I mean, I've been, you know, privy to a number of conversations, just like clinical things, business things, you know, other, you know, ancillary revenue, you know, streams that these practices can take advantage of to create and maintain their independence and that sort of stuff, I think is going to be sort of the wave as we move forward. Because, you know, a big part of that conversation in private practice is like, okay, well, how am I going to pay for it? Right? How am I going to do that? and the conversations and Preston and your background and my background and that sort of like consulting role and sort of saying like, hey, you have a springboard here and we can help you get to that place. And we have surgeons like Dr. Molly and a whole community. We have 100 surgeons that are all private practice that, you know, we're in that position and in that spot. And, you know, I think that's the whole goal of Red Carpet is like, we have solutions for you. We have a pathway for you to get there. It's just like the community, I hope, will create the trust, because I feel like that's the biggest sort of like, you're at the cliff and you're like, oh man, I want to jump off it because I'm miserable right now. But it's like, it's that leap of faith that, you know, you need to get to in order to get to that place.
Real quick, I want to get Preston's thoughts on this, but that cliff analogy reminded me of Dr. Coppola, my mentor's quote that he said to me that really gave me the courage in 2017 to start Whole Health. And we can share that story over drink at some point, Preston, but the quote that he said to me was, what hurts more, the pain of staying the same or the pain of change, right? You're going to have pain regardless. Change is painful, right? No one likes, there's a great book called Who Moved My Cheese that I think everybody should read. And it really got me thinking, it's like, okay, this current pain of employment with people that I'm not aligned with that aren't looking like entrepreneurially like I am, I can just stay here because it's never going to change. Or the pain of this unknown. And to me, it was like, I look at things like a scale. I was like, the energy vampire of that practice was so burdensome that I was like, it's easy. I'm going to do this. It's going to be hard. I have no idea what I'm doing, but I'll figure it out. As a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.